We're beginning the book of Shemot. The book of Shemot will take us through a spiritual and a physical journey. The journey of the Jewish people in rapid decline, morally, spiritually, religiously. And then the Jewish people slowly working their way out of Egypt. Miracles, until we finally reach a point where we all see prophecy. 4/5 of the Jews die along the way. On the one hand, the book of Shemot, Ani le dodi, v'dodi li, dodi li v'ani lo, more accurately, my beloved is to me, I am to him. It's a love song. It's about how God comes and scoops us out of Egypt, does fantastic miracles. No other nation can boast such a history. No one. No one. 10 plagues. Sinai. No one can say they have such a history. One of the greatest proofs to the truth of the Torah. And yet, we have many pitfalls along the way. And every story has its dark cloud within the silver lining. Every story has an element of darkness. When we speak about Egypt, we speak about the Jews leaving monotheism. We speak about the Jews in serious decline spiritually. Our sages say we were on the bottom rung. Another day in Egypt and it would have been over. Pretty bad. We speak about leaving Egypt. We talk about 4 out of 5 Jews dying. We speak about Sinai. We can't forget the golden calf. We speak about the Mishkan. We can't forget that the Mishkan was a default. It wasn't the ideal plan. So the book of Shmos takes us on journeys. Journeys of the Jewish people's ups and downs. A guy came to me the other day. Told me he wants to start dating. I said to him, how long you been religious for? He said, 1.5 years. I said, how many downs have you had? He said, what do you mean by downs? I said, how many times did you enter Shabbos wishing it wasn't Shabbos? How many times did you wake up in the morning and tell yourself, I really don't want to daven today? And I really wonder whether I made the right move becoming religious. And I really ask myself if all my troubles in life don't stem from the fact that I've chosen this path. And I really ask myself, how am I ever going to make it out of here? And will I regret this move for life? He looked at me and said, no, I never had that. I said, then you're not ready to date yet. Part of the tshuva process is going through times when we have questions. And going through times when we don't feel like doing it. And maybe even don't do it. We should do it. Part of growth is the ability to be consistent even when we don't feel like it. Part of being mature is the ability to stick to our decisions even at times when we wouldn't want to. Sticking to decisions because we feel they're right, even though at the moment we don't feel it, but we can stand by our word or our decisions. But at the same time, a person has to have ups and downs. My description wasn't exact. Not everyone's downs are the same. I gave an extreme description, but believe me, I'd say 50% of people who do tshuva go through it that way at some point. And it's important. We'll get to you in a minute. One of the things that proves our dedication to ourselves and maintains our balance is how we survive the downs. How do we come out of the downs? Because life isn't only about ups. And when we look at the book of Shmos, we're going to see a lot of downs. We're going to see an eagle. It doesn't get worse than that. A month and a half earlier, God's telling them, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm the only one. Lo yielecha. You're not allowed to worship any other being. 40 days later, they're bowing to the same calf the Egyptians bowed to in Egypt. That's pretty harsh. So, to a great extent, we can empathize with the Jewish people and their tshuva process. We also have to recognize that when you get through a down, you're stronger. And so too, our time in Egypt is referred to in the Torah as Kur HaBarzel, the purification, the hot furnace that will purify the metal. Iron crucible. Okay. We're going to come out of Egypt with new strengths. And we have a lot to learn from the downs of the Jewish people, not only from the ups. people sometimes question their marriage because they're going through a down. And a down can take a day or a month or years. Part of marriage is that sometimes there are years that are up and there are years that are down. But you know what? When you weather the storm, you have a marriage that's all the better for it. That's all the stronger for it because you've weathered the storm. Life is about ups and downs. And when we start tracing the path of the Jewish people, we're going to see a lot of ups and a lot of downs. And sometimes the quicker we go up, the quicker we go down. Sometimes the more balanced up lasts for longer. When the Jews hit Sinai 40 days out of Egypt, you see 40 days later they're with a golden calf again. Sometimes the building process of 40 years lasts longer than a building process of 40 days. So we're about to enter the journey. Let's begin. Yes, David.
So is it normal for someone who's in the Shiva process to, or even someone who's already gotten there, to forget to bench once, not daven a few times, walk into the bathroom on Shabbat day and then flip the light switch off by accident?
It says in Shulchan Aruch that it is.
You say if we don't do that, then we're not normal?
No. I wasn't talking about what you do. I was talking about what you feel.
Okay.
What a person does, it's natural that when a person is learning something new, that he's not going to perfect it in a day. It says in Shulchan Aruch, when a person becomes a ger, halacha in Shulchan Aruch, you don't look over his shoulder. Don't look. It's halacha. Because it will take him time to perfect it. It's part of life. A guy is just learning, Other people have been doing it for 20 years. He's doing it for 2 years. What can you expect from him? Of course he's going to forget benching sometimes, making a bracha sometimes. That's normal. I never told you a story about the guy who knocked on the door of Rosh Hashanah. He comes, he says, "Hi, I'm new at Machon Meir." I say, "Okay, welcome to Machon Meir." He says, "On my way to your house, my kippah flew off. Do you have a spare kippah?" I say, "Yeah, no problem." We get him a spare kippah. He says, "I have to ask you a question. Now, Erev Rosh Hashanah is a pretty hectic time, So I say, "Okay, can we get you a drink?" Fine, he sits down. I just landed from whatever country, and when I was sitting in the airport waiting for my flight, there was a delay. I went into a Burger King. I had a cheeseburger, and now I came here. And I realized on the flight that I messed up twice. A, I've been eating kosher the last half a year. The burger wasn't kosher, and it was cheese with the burger. Now, I was so used to it, I forgot. I'm in the airport, I'm waiting for the plane, I got carried away, I forgot. How do I do tshuva on that? Erev Rosh Hashanah question, yeah? Not his fault. You know what I told him? Don't do tshuva on that. Look forward, don't look back. You've been building, you made a mistake. Well, you didn't do it purposely, you didn't do it negligently. You're just not yet used to living this type of lifestyle. Look forward. Build good habits. And with time, it'll be second nature not to eat something without seeing a heksher. Look forward. Think about how to build a better year this coming year. And after that, maybe in 5 or 10 years, we'll rethink this cheeseburger. Maybe. But for now, don't think about it. Think forward. Don't think back. Don't let your past detain you. Don't focus on a mistake you did at the airport. Look forward. So every person has their answer, It's not the same answer for someone who's been Jewish his whole life, who walked into a Burger King and had a cheeseburger. It's not going to be the same answer. But for him, okay, look forward. So we're not talking about people who are in the tshuva process and they forget and they turn on a light or their cell phone rings on Shabbos and they answer it and 2 minutes later they realize it's Shabbos. We're not talking about that, no. We're talking about where a person's feelings are and then where a person willfully goes in light of his feelings. Meaning a person will have times when he doesn't feel like sticking with his commitments. A person has decided he's going to adopt a certain way of life and he's not always going to feel like it. And the question is, what happens then? So that's what I'm talking about it down. The fact that sometimes a person remembers more or less, that's practice. Okay, let's begin the parasha.
Still a point where he has those feelings, does that mean he's not ready to date or go forward?
No, I think a person has to have underwent a few times that he's had those feelings and stuck it out. And then he knows that he can withstand the down. He can ride the wave. You know, that's the point. I mean, you have to know that you're stable not only when you feel like it, but that you maintain that stability even when you don't feel like it. And that's what we're going to see in the book of Shmos, that God maintains His relationship with us and His covenant with us in spite of the fact that we're as low as it can get. In spite of that, Hashem is with us. That's one of the great messages of the book of Shmos. We weren't so hot in the book of Shmos. We're going to see. We didn't exactly do such great things. We were amazing, and yet at the same time, we messed up pretty badly. And Hashem stuck it out with us. That's what I'm talking about. In a relationship, God's relationship with us in the book of Shmos, our relationship with God in the tshuva process, the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we sticking it out through the downs? God stuck it out with us. That's what we're going to see in our parsha. Yeah?
What was the other name you said for Shemot, which means purification?
Kur HaBarzel? Kur HaBarzel. Kaf Vav Reish? Kur HaBarzel of metal. So we went down to Egypt with Yaakov Avinu. And I assume you all know the basic storyline of the story of Shmos. Okay, quick overview. Egyptian king comes up. He decides the Jews are a threat. He figures we have to eliminate the threat. Tries to put harsh labor on them. Tries to have the midwives kill the babies. Doesn't work. Has a decree to throw the male children into the Nile. There's an impressive boy born into the house of Levi. He's going to be named Moshe. His mother calls him Tuvia. And he's put in the casket in the Nile, so that the Egyptians won't throw him and kill him in the Nile. Pharaoh's daughter finds him, takes him, adopts him. He grows up in Pharaoh's palace. One day he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew mercilessly. He kills the Egyptian. Pharaoh wants him dead. He runs out to Midian, marries one of Pharaoh's advisor's daughters, Tzipora. God appears to him in a burning bush, tells him, "I've heard the Jews cry, go back, take them out." Moshe refuses for a period until finally God says, "Go," and he goes. Moshe has two children. On the way, he's almost killed because he doesn't circumcise the second one. He comes back and tells Pharaoh he's been sent by God to take the Jews out of Egypt. Pharaoh refuses to listen and makes the work harder. And at the end of the parsha, Moshe turns back to God and says, "What'd you send me for? It only got worse since I came." And God says, "Wait, you're going to see." So that's in 1 minute, our parsha. Now let's see our parsha with more depth. Yaakov took the Jews down to Egypt. There was a famine, and there was a prophecy that Avraham Avinu had that we would be strangers in a land for 400 years. We spent the first 190 years being strangers in Canaan when we had hatred within the brothers that devolved into the decree that we would spend the remaining 210 years in the land of Egypt. We came into Egypt as nobles, as respected people. We were family with the king Yosef, who lived for 80 years being king in Egypt, second to the king, but really he was running the show. And Yosef really saved the Egyptian economy, and Yosef saved the world. He made the Egyptian economy the powerhouse that it was, because they were the only ones that had food at that time, and they gathered the wealth from all over the world. So we started off being pretty good. So long as one of the first 70 were still around, we were good. The first 70 people who came down with Yaakov were each spectacular individuals, worth mentioning individually in the Torah. Our parsha reviews their names as an indication. Those were people worth mentioning. From now, the Jewish people go down a level and they're not worth mentioning by their name. And the Jews will quickly leave their heritage. The Jews will be quick to adopt the pagan ways of the Egyptians. The Jews will be quick to start bowing to the Egyptian idols. And as such, God also makes our stay in Egypt less pleasant. The more we leave God, the less pleasant our stay in Egypt becomes. The more we become pagans, the more the Egyptians put us into forced labor. God sends us a prophet. The prophet tells us, stop being pagans, come back. The Jews aren't interested. And so God says, Va'omar leshpoch chamati aleihem. I said I will pour out my anger against them. Lechalot apivahem b'toch eretz Mitzrayim. I will finish my anger off with them in the land of Mitzrayim. And so Hashem decreed that our stay in Egypt will become a stay of avdut, a stay in which we were turned into slaves. We're going to review now the process of how we became enslaved. But really, this was all a result of our own actions. Technically, down in Egypt, we could have continued as respected individuals had we stuck to our faith. But we didn't. We became hyphenated Jews. You guys know the concept hyphenated American, Chinese American, Jewish American. So we became hyphenated Egyptians. We were Egyptian Hebrews, right. So, we come down to Mitzrayim, and in Pasuk Zion, the Pasuk describes how we flourished, we procreated, paru, they had fruits, they had many children, vayishretzu. The Torah says they squirmed like, you had masses like creepy crawly creatures. Vayishretzu, not such a complimentary term. The Torah wants to say we had a lot of kids. The Torah uses the words we were like shrutzim. You know what a sheretz is? Sheretz is like a snail, like a rat, like there were many of us crawling all over.
Like a slime wolf.
Ah, the Torah is indicating where we were holding. Torah says vayishritzu. We started behaving slimily, right? We started behaving like the creepy, crawly creatures. Why are the shrutzim called shrutzim? Sheretz comes from the word sheratz. The sheretz, we say these creepy crawly creatures are always running to their death. When a cockroach runs across your table, smack, he's finished. Right? They're always running to their death. That's what we became like. The cockroach is doing something very simple. He's running to eat a piece of your sandwich. He doesn't know why you want him dead. He only wanted a piece of your sandwich. Can't you share? Squash. Torah says we became shrutzim. We became focused on our physical desires. The Jewish people went down. They're no longer the Jewish people that entered the land of Egypt. Oh, we maintained certain things. Lo shinu shmam, they didn't change their names. Lo shinu lashonam, they didn't change their language. Lo shinu malbushom, they didn't change their clothing. They still dressed like Jews. So they lived in their ghettos. They had their language. They had their clothes, their names. But everything else, we were like Egyptians. And so, Hashem established a king, a new king, who could not fathom that the great Yosef had anything to do with these ghetto creatures. These are lowlifes. Yosef was a brilliant, kind man. These Jews, what are they? And so the king is not willing to recognize that there's any connection with the aristocratic Yosef who saved Egypt and these vermin. The Torah calls us vermin. The Torah says, Vayishritzu. And so he's disgusted. His land is being filled with ghettos. He turns to his people and he says, this nation is outnumbering us. We have a demographical challenge here. We have to outsmart them. We have to cause them to want to leave. So Paro says to his people, what we have to do is ensure that they want to leave, because otherwise they're going to multiply, and when there'll be a time of war, they're not one of us. If they refuse to dress like us and talk like us and eat like us, we bow to the cow, they're still eating cows. So we have a problem with these people. They're not one of us, and then they're a danger. So we're going to afflict them, and then they're going to want to leave. This goes hand in hand. After we are being described as Vayishritzu, we started multiplying like vermin. Once we went down a level, so Paro sees us as a threat. And that's been our Jewish history throughout. Whenever we wanted to be like the nations, that's when the nations started being fed up with us. When you had German Jews who wanted to be like the Germans, you had the whole Haskala movement, people saying if we'll just be more like them, they won't hate us. That's when they hated us more. So, here in Egypt, the Jews became more like Egyptians, and that's exactly what the Torah describes happened. The Egyptians then started seeing them as a threat. Then they saw the little nuances, they were not completely Egyptian, and then they said, we have to afflict them, and then they'll leave. So they lay a tax. All Jews must build arei miskanos, storage houses for Pharaoh. And the storage houses are Pitom and Ramses. They build them on a fault line where every few days it shakes, there are tremors, and everything they built collapses. Everything they built, people die. And they figure, no one's going to be willing to do that. eventually they're going to say, forget it, we're not staying here. We're packing our bags and leaving. But it doesn't work. The Jews don't work that way. We're stiff-necked. And if they tell us to work, so we're just going to show we're more faithful. So we kept working. And the Egyptians look at us and say, what's wrong with them? If we afflict them like this, they should pack out and leave. We'd never let anyone treat us like this. We'd never let anyone treat us as badly as we're treating them. Think about what's happening in this country today. No country in the world would allow people to shoot missiles into their country without declaring war. No country in the world. Show me another country. Show me one.
But would you repeat yourself again?
No country in the world would be constructing streets, okef after okef after okef. We're going to construct the street to go around this Arab village because they're throwing rocks at our cars. Now they build a village next to that street. So we'll build another street that goes around that village so that they'll stop throwing rocks at our cars. Show me another country in the world that would behave this way. Show me another country in the world that would accept missiles falling on their citizens and not react. I haven't seen one yet. I mean, if this weren't true, it would be comic. And that's what happened with us in Egypt. The Egyptians said, we'll make life miserable for them. They'll leave. Wrong. Not when you're dealing with the Jews. You make it miserable, so the Jews, where in the world do you have buses guarded against rocks that they'll throw at you? You know, maybe in countries that aren't developed. So there, you have the high class. They walk around in their tanks. You go to Mexico. People can travel in helicopters so that they don't get hijacked, right? You know, in Mexico, if you have a lot of money, you can't travel by car. They might put a gun to your head. So you have these countries where they're not half the country or two-thirds of the country is uncivilized. And if you could call that, undeveloped. I shouldn't say uncivilized. Undeveloped. And then you have the upper class. They protect themselves. But where do you have a country where the whole country is living like a Western country? But you have the Wild West with people carrying guns around. Everyone's walking around guns, yeah. I haven't seen this in any Western country. You know, go to England, show me a person walking around with a gun. You ever think of the paradox, what's happening here? You have a country that on the one hand is developed, on the other hand we're walking around, we all have to carry guns, right? Every store you walk into has to have some guard out there protecting this wonderful piece we have. You have to watch it so it doesn't disappear. So you have guards out there. They're all watching the piece. We're all watching this piece that somehow is going to pieces. But we have peace because we have guards. And on the one hand, developed. On the other hand, we're undeveloped. Which one are we? We're Jews. Which means that you hit us. Okay. So we'll figure out another way. It's not necessarily an asset. You know, it's a strength sometimes. We've maybe taken it a little bit too far. Yes, sir?
Rabbi, you said that when we try to assimilate into Gentile culture that they hate us more. But there was many instances in Europe, I was reading in this history of the book in the library, that when Jews were so faithful to Judaism and refused to even convert to Christianity, that like the Moranos did in Spain, like they remained so stubborn, like it's clearly said that the Catholic priests during that time would have actually liked the Jews if they would convert into Christians. But because the Jewish resistance to that was so strong, like, okay, it's better to be a secular Jew rather than to believe in, the stick boy and...
That's a long conversation. So tomorrow night.
How come they hate us? How come they was... So I think it contradicts this idea that, you know, if we try to mix with the Gentiles, that they'll love, they hate us more, but it's...
Okay, so tomorrow night. It's worth discussing, but I assume you want a longer conversation than 1 minute. So let's talk about tomorrow night. No, let's talk about tomorrow night. It's not. I'll say one thing, you'll say another thing. I'll say one thing, you'll say another thing, and each time it'll be another minute, and we'll lose half the class. So, let's move forward. So the Egyptians saw that there was no limit to how degrading they could be to the Jews. That whatever they do, the Jews just grin and bear it. So finally they decided, okay, they're going to be our slaves. And this went hand in hand with our moral behavior, our spiritual behavior. We went further downhill in our spiritual decline. Maybe we thought if we'd be more like them, they'd treat us more like them. Maybe. And so the Egyptians put us in forced labor and they made us work avodas parech. What is avodas parech? That is backbreaking work. What is backbreaking work? One understanding is that's when you make a man do a woman's job and a woman do a man's job. That's what they do. The women were doing men's work outside, men were doing women's work inside. One understanding is, and this is a halachic understanding, farach is pointless work. You tell a person, I want you to dig out all the sand from here, move it over there. Now, I want you to take it back and put it where you took it out from. Pointless work. That's avodas parach. Another understanding, which is also quoted in halacha, it's quoted in halacha because we have a prohibition from behaving this way. You're not allowed to take a servant and have him do avodas parach. You're not allowed to tell him to do avodas parach, which is either pointless work or endless work. You tell him, I want you to dig till I tell you to stop. You just keep digging. I'll tell you when to stop. And that's also avodas parach.
Now,
what?
They
couldn't exactly leave the country. They had policemen watching over them. Chazal tells it was an involvement. The first day the Egyptians said, everyone's going to work. And they even brought Paro in. And the Congress decided Paro also has to show up to the workforce that day. So the Jews, being good citizens, they said, if Paro works and all the Egyptians work, we have to be faithful citizens, we work too. The tribe of Levi said, I'm learning. The other Jews said, but you got to be a good citizen. Tribe of Levi said, I'm learning. But what's going to be about, what are they going to think of us? What's going to be?
Even the women?
I'm learning. I don't know anything of this. I'm learning.
Even the women?
And it says the tribe of Levi were not worked. And once they didn't work, once they became the learning class, they remained that way. And this is an important attitude. If you want to grow in learning, you sometimes have to have that attitude. Everything else will manage without me. Right now I'm learning. And you'll see that the people who have that attitude, they succeed, they grow. They can remain focused, they can keep growing. The tribe of Levi, they didn't budge. You guys will go. I'm not going. So slowly it evolved to the point where one day, the next day Paro didn't come. The next day the Egyptians weren't working. The next day the Egyptians were already standing with whips over the Jews. To the point where they'd come in the middle of the night and take them out of bed. To the point where they'd say, there's no point in you going back to bed because in a minute I'm coming to bring you to work. And the Jews would go to sleep in the field. And the women would come out to the field. And of course, when men and women are being worked so hard, the women are doing the men's work and the men are doing the women's work. So who collapses first? The men. Who's stronger between the two genders? The women. So the Chazal tells us that's exactly what happened. The women and the men were doing women's work, women were doing men's work. Who collapsed? The men. The women would come out to the field and say, let's have supper together. And he'd say, forget it. I don't have strength. And she'd go out to the well, and she'd draw water. She's been doing man's work all day. She'd draw the water, and God would make a miracle, and a bunch of little fish would come to the water. If you eat little fish, it helps you procreate. And they'd bring these little fish, they'd put them on a fire, they'd cook the water and the fish. And the men would be lying there, and they wouldn't have strength to move. And the women would say, let's have supper together. And he'd say, I don't have strength. And she'd feed him. And then they'd sit under the apple tree. Apple in Tanakh is esrog. Yeah? So they'd sit under the esrog trees, and the women would take out their mirrors, and they'd look in the mirror, and they'd make their hair, and they'd say to the man, look at how good we look. And the man would try to look, and she'd say, who looks better, me or you? And slowly they'd be able to arouse their husbands, and that's how they ensured that the Jewish people would continue. The psukim in Tehillim describe that the men would say, it's immodest out here in the fields. The women would say, you're right. Every field would end up with you'd plow all the earth. At the end, the plow makes a pile of earth at the end of the path, right? Each time it plows, it brings up all the earth. Till then, at the end of each field, you'd have a raise in the earth. The earth would go up. So the couples would lie in between two fields where the earth went up, and there they'd have their modesty. And tachat ha-tapuach orticha, under the apple tree, under the esrog tree, I aroused you. They didn't have much of a choice. In Egypt, it didn't rain. Their water comes from the Nile, right?
Where was the flood?
Good question. So, the Pasuk describes that that's how the Jewish people remained. And when the women would come later to donate those mirrors for the work of the temple, Moshe looked at the mirrors and said, come on, these are things that you beautify yourself to entice men with. It's not exactly fitting for God's home. And God says, no. Thanks to those mirrors, they kept the Jewish people going. People think a modest woman is a woman that's not beautiful. Incorrect. A modest woman is supposed to be beautiful for her husband. She's supposed to be beautiful for her husband and modest about it. Modest in Hebrew means tsanua. Tsanua comes from the word mutzne, hidden. The idea is beauty that's hidden. Doesn't have to be flaunted, doesn't have to be shown to other people, but it's still beautiful. Tsniut is not about taking away the beauty. It's about covering it, keeping it hidden for the proper people for the proper time. So the women, when they want to donate the mirrors, God says, I love those mirrors. The women used those mirrors correctly. Thanks to those mirrors, they were able to keep the Jewish people going.
So where does that come from? Is that a Midrash? Or?
Where does what come from?
That whole story about the...
Part of it's a Gemara in Sota, part of it's a Medrash Rabbah here, part of it's a Medrash Rabbah in Shir Shirim. You could look up the Medrash under the Pasuk Tachat HaTapuach Ochalticha, and you could look up the Medrash on the Pasuk B'marot HaTzoveot Asher Tzavu Petach Ol Moed in Parshas VeYakel. So, and about the fish in the water, it's either Pirkei Rabbi Elazar or Gemara and Soto. One or the other, I don't remember. So the Egyptians made us work parech, and they embittered our lives. The Jews would be making mortar, and the Egyptians came the first day when everyone was fresh. They'd write down the quota. How much did this Jew produce? How much did that Jew produce? And they'd say, every day you have to live up to that first day when you still had strength. And they'd whip them, and they'd make Jewish kapos, and they'd tell the Jewish men, you ensure they produce this much. If you don't, we'll hit you. And the Jewish kapos would bend down and help the Jews in their work. They'd try to help them get to the quota, and they would not whip them. They would be beaten, but they wouldn't whip the other Jews. If a Jew wouldn't live up to his quota, they'd take his child and put him in the mortar, and they'd say, that's to help you fill the quota. So you had Jews mixing the mortar, and in the middle of the mortar, they'd have blood from Jewish children that were being thrown in because they didn't fill their quota. And on Pesach night, when we dip our maror in the charoses, our custom is that we pour some wine on the charoses to remind ourselves of the mortar that we were mixing, and had to see children's blood floating through the mortar as we were mixing it. At one point, Moshe Rabbeinu is traveling throughout Egypt, and he sees a baby boy that was stuck into the walls because they hadn't filled the quota, and he turns to God and says, how could this be? God says, I'm helping the people. These are souls that would have destroyed the Jewish people. And for whatever reason, they had to come to the world, but the fact that these babies are dying is better for the world. And I'll prove it to you. Take one out and you'll see what will happen with him. Maybe tomorrow night we'll discuss what happens with the baby that Moshe takes out.
Oh, it's up in the temple of Mika's...
Beautiful, you know. Excellent. So you'll tell the whole class after class, okay? So, Paro calls in the midwives that live near him in his capital city, Shifra and Pua. We have on tradition that was Yocheved and her daughter-in-law, or Yocheved and her daughter Miriam. And he says, when you give birth, I want you to see on the birthing stone, if it's a boy, kill him. And the midwives, they refuse to listen. They don't tell him no. They say, sure, your majesty. And they do the exact opposite. They support, they give life support to the babies. So the king sees that the midwives who were told by him in his city don't listen to him. He figures this plan isn't going to work. He figured he'll do an experiment. If it works in the capital, then he'll start telling all the other midwives in all the other cities that's what they should do. But when the head midwives refuse him, he calls them in and says, why'd you do this? You know, you told me you'd listen, and then you did the exact opposite. So they said, no, you don't understand. The Jewish women have so many kids. They know exactly what a midwife's supposed to do. We're still trying to get on their good side so that we could outsmart them, so that we could kill more babies for you. You don't want us to kill just one. You want us to kill all of them. We can't do it all abruptly, just kill everyone. So they figured an excuse. Notice the difference between men and women. Women say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they say, but, but. And then they say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But they do what they want. Men, no. Not so smart. They got away. They were living. Men go head on. Women say yes and then do what they want. It's the wisdom of women to be non-confrontational. Right. So they got blessed for it. Chazal tell us this was the mother of Moshe. She saved other women's children, and that's why she married it to have the child that would save all of the Jewish people. Sometimes we think all kinds of thoughts. You know, if I don't do this, he might have my head. Why should I risk my head for them? If Miriam and Yocheved would have started thinking along those lines, they could have thought, we if we only listen to him a little bit, if we only kill a child here, kill a child there, he'll be happy. If they would have compromised on their belief, they would have really been compromising on helping the Jewish people long term and helping themselves. Miriam merited to have kings and prophets from her. Yocheved merited to have Moshe, Kohanim Gedolim. Everything came from Yocheved. Yocheved had Aaron and Moshe. Had she tried to compromise, just find a way to you know, sometimes this way, sometimes that way, she would have not only hurt the Jewish people by killing those babies, and she could have said to herself, you know, these babies are going to be dead anyways. If Paro wants them dead, he's going to throw them in the Nile, he's going to put them in the mortar. Who's going to stop Paro? Why should I risk my life to save them? She could have given herself all kinds of reasons why it would be okay for her to do it. But she didn't. She did what was right. In life, we often have to stop and say, what's right, right here? I don't have to do God's work for him. Whether Paro will kill these children later or not, that's God's question. It's not my question. My question right now is, what's right for me to do here? And what's right is either yes or no. And by Yocheved, the answer was no. I have no right to hurt these babies. So she didn't. And she didn't start thinking, well, what's it going to mean for me? What's going to happen to me in the end? She thought, what's right over here? Schindler only saved Jews because he thought of it that way. In life, if you start thinking 10 steps down the road, you'll always have reasons to do what's wrong. You'll always have reasons to think, well, if I do what's wrong, it'll only turn out right. It doesn't work that way. You've got to do what's right over here. So Yocheved and Miriam did, and that's why they ended up saving the Jewish people. So Paro decrees that they have to throw the kids into the Nile. Why does he want to throw the boys into the Nile? Well, he wants the girls for prostitution. Why does he want to throw the boys into the Nile? His stargazers see that the Redeemer of the Jewish people is a boy. And so the story goes that a man comes from the house of Levi. Anytime we have the word Ish, Ish means a leader. He happens to be the head of the Jewish people. Notice that the tribe of Levi is heading the Jewish people. Where'd they go from? From Yaakov cursing them. At the end of Yaakov's days, they were at the bottom rung. Yaakov looks at Shimon and Levi and says, you too, huh? He's got a word or two to tell him, nothing too positive. Where did Levi take that? Levi had a son named Amram, right? Levi's son Amram could have said, I can't amount to much. My grandfather didn't leave us with a blessing. Yaakov didn't bless us. We've often said, we can't let our past define our future. Every person could look into his past and say, but I haven't yet lived up to what I should. The question is, what will I do tomorrow? Not what did I do yesterday? It's our job to build our future and not to let our past constrict our future. And so we find that when Levi passes away, the leader of the Jewish people is Amram. He is the Gadol HaDor. He's the Rav Eliashiv of the generation. When people have questions, he's the one they look to. And when Paro decrees that all the boys will be thrown into the Nile, Amram makes a fatal error. We have a rule in halacha that we don't change halacha because of decrees. We say halacha is eternal and decrees are finite. We say gzera avido debatlo. The decree will pass. The Jewish people are eternal. We'll be long-winded. We're not going to change things in a major way just because there's a decree. We'll find ways of getting around the decree. So Amram divorces his wife. He has a wife that's over a century old. And he divorces her. And she miraculously is pregnant when he divorces her. And they don't know it. And then his daughter comes to him and says, Dad, you're worse than Paro. So he doesn't smack her. He doesn't say, chutzpah, how do you talk to me that way? I'm the head of the Jewish people. Who do you think you are? He says, really? Why do you think so? And she says, Paro only decreed to kill the boys. You're killing the boys and the girls. So he says, you're right. So the top leader of the Jewish people listens to his daughter. When he divorced his wife, all of the Jews divorced their wives. When he remarries his wife, all of the Jews remarry their wives. Who got all of the Jews remarried? Miriam, this little girl. And Amram, in his modesty, how she should have been somewhere around three. Somewhere around there. We don't have an exact tradition.
Rivka was three when she was... Oh no, Rivka was three when she was married to Yitzhak, so she must have had those capabilities. You know.
Okay, just a second. Yes, Yonatan.
Amram was the first Levite and Cohen, right?
No, Amram didn't seem to live to get out of Egypt.
Okay, because I was because the thing is, why I'm asking is because I thought if Amram was the first Cohen, so if he divorced his wife, he would be you are not allowed to marry wife, but it seems like it was not the code, so it's okay.
Right.
Torah, so.
Amram had a bigger problem. He married his aunt. When the Torah would be given, he'd have to divorce her anyways. But he wasn't around.
We don't know how much older Mary was Moses.
Well, it seems like she was younger than Aaron, and Aaron was 3 years older than Moshe. So that puts her under three, right? That's a little bit complex. We don't know when she died either. But we have certain traditions about her. We know that she was sickly, she was weak, no one wanted to marry her. She was an old woman. When they left Egypt, she was over 80. She wasn't yet married. Pretty old. Then she got married to...
She gave her beauty after the forgiveness for the Tzara.
Right, right. Then she got beautiful and she got married. But earlier, Kalev married her.
So we know for sure it's married.
Wait, who married her?
Kalev.
Oh, the first Zionist who entered Hebron.
Okay, yes, sir. What were you asking, Michael?
We know for sure that it's Miriam and Yocheved that were...
No, so Machloged, it might have been Yocheved and her daughter-in-law, Elisheva.
It wouldn't make sense that a two-year-old would be going around...
No, but she had the feelings of the 18-year-old, you know, maybe. Because
Rivka
got married.
Okay, so... The Egyptians were checking all the houses to see when babies were born, and either it wasn't a rarity that women over 100 were giving birth, or else they were suspicious of Yocheved because she had given birth twice in the last 3 years, even though she was over 100. So at any rate, they're checking her house. And she sees she can't keep Moshe in hiding. So the Medrash says that all other women would take their kids out to the forest. And there's a fascinating medrash that the babies would be swallowed into the ground. The Egyptians would come plowing over them to try and kill them. And Hashem would bring them down into a cave. And they'd have two rocks, one rock with honey and one rock with milk. And they lived off of those rocks. And then they grew up and they sprouted out of the ground. And then they'd walk home. Whatever the medrash means, I don't know. But somehow the kids did manage to live out in the woods away from the Egyptians. They had some kind of Puritans, whatever... partisans. They had some kind of movement in the forest where they could hide the kids. That's what the Medrash seems to say. But at any rate, they didn't. Yocheved goes to the Nile at a time when no one can tell, and she puts the baby in a casket in the reeds. And being that the Egyptians had decreed that the babies have to be thrown into the Nile because they saw that the leader of the Jewish people will ultimately fall at the hands of water. So the second Moshe's casket hits the water, the stargazers come to Pharaoh and they say, we see that the Jewish baby has been put into the Nile already. You could abolish the decree. Because on that day that he was born, 3 months earlier, the Egyptians already made a decree, all children, Egyptian or non-Egyptian, all boys get thrown into the Nile. Because the Egyptians saw in the stars that this Jewish baby that's going to be born, we see he's going to be in an Egyptian home and a Jewish home. We're not so sure if he's going to be born to the Jews or the Egyptians. So that they saw right. I mean, Moshe grew up in Paro's home. So, for 3 months, they've been throwing Jewish and Egyptian babies, every baby born, into the Nile. And now, when Moshe's casket hits the Nile, they look in the stars, the stargazers run to Paro, they tell him, stop the decree, he's hit the Nile. So they stop the decree. Paro's daughter has decided her father's wrong. She's going to join Judaism. She's going to join monotheism. So she goes to the Nile to immerse herself. She has girls who are always with her, all her girlfriends. And...
Is this a mikveh, so to speak?
Well, the Nile is the best mikveh they had there, right?
So she went to convert.
And Batya, the daughter of Paro, Batya, daughter of God, she adopted monotheism. Batya came to the Nile to convert. Where's the Judaism? Torah hasn't yet been given. So she comes to the Nile. Now, the big sister has been standing by the Nile thinking, you know, the Egyptians, they all cheat on their wives and the wives cheat on their husbands. The Navi Yechezkel describes that in Egypt, no one knew who their father or mother was. But every so often, they actually knew that the baby wasn't theirs. So if the wife would have a baby that was very obvious it wasn't her husband was out on a business trip, and then she'd have a baby. So she'd take the baby, and when her husband was coming home, she'd leave him out in the marketplace, hoping someone would gather him. That type of baby is called an asufi. In Jewish history, we've also had that. Women who gave birth out of wedlock would sometimes leave their baby by the rabbi's doorstep. Rabbis very often would bring up children that were not their own because women gave birth out of wedlock, and they somehow the rabbi would suddenly hear a knock on the door, open the door, and see a basket there with a baby. In some towns, the women were very poor. If they knew they'd have no food for the baby, so like Rav Chaim of Brisk, he had many kids in his house. They'd leave babies by his doorstep simply because they couldn't afford to feed them. I think we're going to have to hold off on questions. We're really behind. We've got to rush forward. So they figured if they put him over there, some Mitzri will pick him up and figure this is an Asufi, this is some bastard, some kid that someone left in the Nile. And the sister is waiting on the sidelines, waiting to see what's going to happen. So she waits to see, and Batya goes into her private bath that's right by the Nile. Her girlfriends are all walking out by the Nile. She has her maids with her, and she sends a maid to see what's in the basket, or she extends her own hand. Chazal say that her hand extended a tremendous distance, like I'd say from about here till the end of the block, if you figure a tremendous distance. You know, her hand extends out, and she pulls in the basket, and she looks inside, and she sees a baby, but he's a beautiful baby. And he's a baby that moves like a na'ar. Why is a teenager called a na'ar? Because na'ar means that movement that is incomplete. A teenager does a lot of movements that are incomplete. So he was a baby, but he was doing movements that were closer to a teenager's movements. He was impressive, he was unusual. And up walks his sister and sees her holding the baby. And she says, "You want me to bring you a nurse from the Hebrews?" Batya has already figured out he's a Jewish child. She sees he's circumcised. She sees he's beautiful. She sees he's white. The Egyptians were black. Batya says, "This is a Jewish boy. This isn't an Asufi. A boy that's so beautiful, no one would leave here if not for the Hebrews. No. This is a Hebrew who wanted to save the boy's life." So when Batya walks over to her and offers a Hebrew wet nurse, Miriam is offering her what she'd like, because she figures, you know, if he's used to the Hebrews' diet, they eat different than the Egyptians, right? So then she needs, this baby is used to a Hebrew diet. He's going to do best with a wet nurse that's a Hebrew. Chazal tell us, if a Jewish boy needs to be nursed by a wet nurse, we may take a non-Jewish wet nurse, provided that you don't have to worry for anti-Semitism, that you'll kill the baby, right? But if it's a situation where she knows she'll get caught and there's law and order in the country, not like was the case in Europe for many years, where if you killed a Jew, nothing would really happen. But if it was a situation where you can rely on her, so you could take a non-Jewish wet nurse, but you should ensure that when she's nursing your baby for that period, she should eat only kosher food. Why? Because Chazal tell us over here, why did she want a Jewish wet nurse? Because Moshe wouldn't nurse from the Egyptian women. Why wouldn't he nurse from the Egyptian women? Because a mother's milk is formed from the food she eats. The Egyptian women ate non-kosher food. And God said, a child that's going to talk to me, pel peh, that child shouldn't eat non-kosher food. Now, here we see an interesting halacha. The halacha says, you have a baby, you have to give that baby the potential to be Moshe Rabbeinu. You say to yourself, wait a second. How many Jews, you know, nursed from people who ate non-kosher food and they turned out to be fine adults? It only affects a person who's as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, Halacha says, yeah, but you have to give your kid the potential to be Moshe Rabbeinu. If you're going to take a non-Jewish wet nurse, ensure that she eats kosher, the period she's nursing, so that the food that the baby gets is kosher and you're leaving him the potential to be Moshe Rabbeinu. So, obviously, Miriam calls the mother, Yocheved, and Yocheved is nursing the baby, and she's getting paid for it. She's bringing up her own baby and being paid by the Egyptian princess to do so. When they had to put the baby in the casket in the Nile, so the father calls in Miriam and says, let's rewind. When they got remarried, and when the baby was born, and they saw how beautiful he was, and that the house filled with light, so Miriam said, yes, I've seen in prophecy that my mother will have a child who will save the Jewish people. Her father kissed her on the head. Little girl had a prophetic vision. She said, my mother is going to have the boy that saves the Jewish people. Her prophecy came true. He kissed her on her head. 3 months later, when they have to put the baby in the casket in the Nile, her father taps her on the head and says, where's your prophecy now, girl? For 7 days, she's embarrassed. She doesn't talk to Amram. later on in her life, when God's upset at her, God will refer back to this occurrence and say, when her father was upset at her, he spit, he tapped her on the head and said, where's your prophecy now? For 7 days she was embarrassed to talk to him. When I'm upset at her, you don't think she should stay away for 7 days? This story is going to be quoted to Miriam later. So Moshe grows up. And Batyas names him Moshe, which means the one who pulls others. She doesn't call him Mashui, the one who was pulled, because she said, even though I pulled him out of the waters, but it was very unusual that I noticed him and that I saved him. Obviously, God wants this child for a purpose. And his purpose is obviously going to be to lead others. So instead of calling him Mashui, the one who was pulled out of the waters, she calls him Moshe, the one who will draw out others, which came true. Notice that in her act of kindness, we adopt the name that she named him. You guys didn't know he was named Yekusiel, Yered, Avizonoach, Tuvia. Moshe was probably named Tuvia by his parents. God is good. Tuvia. That was Moshe's name. Doesn't even say it in the Torah. We all call him Moshe. We take the name of his adoptive mother. A person who adopts a child, it's as though they've raised him. They've saved his life. So we all know him as Moshe. Now, did Batya speak Hebrew or did she name him Moneus and the Torah translates it to Moshe? Different opinions among the commentaries. Moshe grows up and he wants to go out and see what's doing with his brothers. And that same day, a man named Dasan has been pulled out of his bed by his Egyptian master. The Egyptian walks in the middle of the night and says, get out to work. So Dasan, his wife, was always very nice to the Egyptians. She was always talkative and friendly. And this Egyptian thought she was good looking. So he pulls Dasan out of bed, throws him out to work. Dasan goes out to the field. He's working. He's half asleep. Doesn't know what's hitting him. He's working. The Egyptian comes back into bed. The wife thinks it's Dasan. It's the middle of the night. The Egyptian sleeps with her. He's leaving the house, and Dustin's groggily walking back home. Dustin's walking back home, and he's thinking, gee, I was working out there all alone. It was the middle of the night. Something's wrong here. He comes back. He meets the Egyptian. He looks inside the tent. He sees his wife. He figures out what happened. The Egyptian sees that he figured out what happened. The Egyptian starts beating him. The Egyptian figures he's going to die. He's not going to tell anyone what I did. As he's beating Dustin, up walks Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe just walked out of the palace. Moshe looks at the scene, and in 1 second he understands what's going on. He looks to his left, he looks to his right, he sees only Jews. So he says God's hidden name, and the Egyptian drops dead. Before he killed the Egyptian, he looked at him and was able to see prophetically that nothing good would ever come out of him in future generations, and the Egyptian drops dead. He buries him in the sand. The next day he's going out, and Dasan and his brother, Aviram, Dasan and Aviram were two brothers, they're fighting. And Dasan lifts his hand to sack Aviram. And Moshe, he's impartial, he really couldn't care less, he's treating them both as brothers. He says to him, Rasha, you're lifting a hand to hit him? So the guy looks at him and says, are you going to do that EGBG now and just say something and make me drop dead too? I'm going to go tell Paro. Moshe looks at him and says, I don't understand. I relied on all the Jews when I killed him yesterday. I risked my life to save your life. You're going